Last few weeks we've been looking at what's often been called the three pillars of Lent, prayer and fasting, what we talked about the first couple of weeks. Prayer, obviously something that, you know, no matter your background, prayer is something as a Christian that comes up a lot. I was looking at prayer from the perspective of kind of what goes on when you're alone. Today, at some point, probably at the end of my message, I'm going to pray. And when I pray, I'm going to talk the whole time. That's so different than how I pray when I'm alone. There's a lot of time spent listening and just being silent when I pray. It's almost kind of weird to use the same word for what happens when I pray when I'm alone as when I'm with you guys. And that we kind of, 2 weeks ago, we kind of looked into that that prayer, that time. With God, when we are seeking out his face and asking to see the world through his eyes, not trying to get him to conform the world to our will, but to really understand and to see the world as he sees it so that we can truly submit and have integrity in submitting to him. Last week, we looked at fasting, the absence, primarily the absence of eating. And we looked at Jesus in his 40 days out in the wilderness, not just fasting from food, but the absence of people, like that he put himself in a position to want to be to approach God in the absence of both food and people, to be silent and alone in his fasting, to approach God from a position of hunger. We talked about that last week, and today we want to look at almsgiving. I almost didn't use the word almsgiving because I was like, man, that's a strange... So the only time I ever hear, like, I was trying to think, like, when was the last time I ever heard the word alms? And I think it was like a Monty Python skit. alms for the poor, something like that, you know? It's not something you hear very often. Almsgiving is just defined as something given freely to relieve the poor. Usually... it's thought of in terms of like giving money to someone who is in real need. Stereotypically, you would imagine somebody on the street corner, shaking a tin cup and putting money in there. And thank you, sir. I picture everybody in the exchange with a British accent. That's kind of what you think of in terms of almsgiving. But we're going to look at like what it really means. What does it mean to be poor? What does it mean to truly give out of poverty, give from a position of having? So this is the key, is that anything that you are truly contributing to something else, someone else, is something that you have to contribute. And this is going to be fundamentally important. Jesus was exceedingly frustrating to almost everyone that he came in contact with. Because they were confident about their need. They knew for a fact that the source, the fundamental, like the root of the oppression in their life was the occupation of their land, their holy land, by the Roman Empire. And the Messiah was going to come and was going to relieve them of that oppression. And Jesus, from day one, from the start of his ministry to the end, people kept showing up because, man, he was super interesting, and they kept bailing on him because he did not provide what they wanted. He did not have to give what they assumed that the Messiah should give. That relationship is going to come into play when we talk about almsgiving in our culture now. 200 years ago, 92% of people in the United States lived off of what would today be $20 a day. Like in those dollars, man, $20 a day 200 years ago, you'd be living like a king. But like in today's dollars, 92% of people lived off of less than $20 a day. 100 years ago, that was 52%. Today, that's 1.2%. And I don't mean like, oh, the dollar has changed its value. I mean, no, taking inflation into account, that standard of poverty, are you living off of less than $20 a day, either through your own income or through charitable giving, through the government providing? living on less than $20 a day, that has dropped from 92% of the population to 1.2% of the population, which means a couple of things are going on. One, we have to keep redefining what it means to be impoverished. What it meant to be impoverished 200 years ago was dramatically different than what it means to be impoverished today. And what it means to give, how you contribute, how you can help a person in need is dramatically different. When 92% of people around you, almost every 9 out of 10 people that you're coming in time, you are almost certainly one of those people, are living on so little, awareness of immediate need is constant. If I happen to, for some reason, have some period of time of excess, I had to slaughter a cow, or there was some reason that in this moment, for this month, I happened to have more than I needed, I was going to be in a position that I needed to contribute to my neighbors because they had contributed to me when I needed, or I wouldn't be here right now. Constantly providing for each other in your deepest need was the only way that almost everybody made it. So charitable giving to people you were around was literally how the world, that's how people survived. Now it's almost like, I don't know, how many people do I know that need my financial support to thrive? They might need me to tell them how to, like, oh, you can, there's the community crisis center that Horizon contributes to. Let me show you where that is. Or there's like, but how many people, like, it's just very rare at this point, right? It's a very different thing. So when we talk about almsgiving, we're going to do one of two things. Either we're going to redefine what need is and keep expanding need into something more and more and more. That's one option. Or we will think about, although our culture has an excess of financial wealth, we have a complete absence of other things that are essential to human thriving. When I was in, several of you guys have taken trips to the Dominican. I know I went when I went down to the Dominican. The first few places that I went to. So my parents grew up in Southeast Georgia, kind of on the swamp. Like I remember them not having indoor plumbing. I remember taking baths in the wash tub. You know, I remember the outhouse. Like, I remember, like, poor, right? I mean, I didn't live there, but I visited there every summer, right? That's how my parents grew up. And so when I first went to the Dominican, I was like, I mean, they're kind of poor, but, you know, whatever. Like, I've seen this. Until we went to the mountains. We drove up, it was like the third day. We went up into the mountains, and when this little girl, I happened to have a daughter the same age, like, 3 maybe, I saw her coming up the side of the mountain holding a gallon jug from wherever she was pulling, getting the water to bring it back up to her house up the mountain, and she was just wearing like underwear, you know. I was like, it kind of like that hurt me. I was like, okay, this is a little bit different, you know, because we were flying along and this little girl's right on the side of the road. That's her job, to go get the water for the family. And I'm like, okay, there's some poverty happening here. And we went to go visit this church who was doing this, just amazing, in that community that was really poor. They had a very high death rate for all kinds of diseases, and they had created a system. They had created these maps of the mountainside, of every village in the mountainside, and in the maps they had drawn all the houses, and in all the houses they had pins in each house that would be either blue or pink, representing people in each of those. And for each pin, they had a file for any information they had on everybody in the house. It was 19,000 people that this church of 200 had mapped out all of the people in the countryside. And they had figured out how to alleviate. I think it was things like unhealthy water or like giving birth, like things that didn't cost much, but they were quickly able to create great outcomes health-wise for these 19,000 people around them. They were able to connect this one clinic with the individuals. They would go to the houses, like they were on a, they would go to the houses and they would do a checklist and they would connect the clinic with them. They, like the health outcomes for this whole mountainside dramatically increased as a result of what this church was doing in this impoverished area. And I was, I don't know if jealous is the right word. I was like, this church that I'm starting, my church isn't this church, you know? And I was talking, Francisco, still remember his name. I was talking to Francisco and I asked him, I said, listen, like everything you're doing here is beautiful. I wouldn't even know how to minister to my community the way you do because our needs aren't like your needs. And he said, for people that have everything, he meant people who have what they need, their greatest need is to give. That was it. That's all he said. So their greatest need is to give. And I thought, what does poverty look like in Reisterstown? For people who are not impoverished the way these people are, my options are to keep reinventing poverty, to keep, there's no end to how much I redefine as need, or I recognize that the needs radically, the human need to be valuable, to be needed, to be helpful, to be significant in the lives of other people, to be a person who gives. Francisco was telling me, when you have what you need, your greatest need is to give. So he was telling me that what it means to provide isn't just a matter of like chasing greater and greater need, but to look and notice what the actual needs of your community are. One thing we identified was the way that they knew their neighbors dramatically different than the way we know our neighbors. It is, this is something that at another village we went to, there was a lady that was showing us around, was talking about like, I forgot what she was saying, but I was like, oh, it sounds like everybody knows their neighbor. She looked at me, she said, you can't not know your neighbor. Like if you have a fight, you can't pretend you didn't have a fight with your spouse. Like she said, look at the homes. Everyone that lives near you knows that you had a fight with your spouse. Everyone hears everything that's going on in your life. There is no privacy the way you think of it. That's a certain amount, that's a certain kind of poverty, but there's also a certain kind of richness in that. Everyone is known. Everyone knows. And here, it's almost like you have to fight to be known, you know? So that was a different type of poverty that we identified that we needed to address. So if we are going to think about almsgiving, the tenet of almsgiving, we are either going to think, and, you know, not that it can't be both, we're either going to think in terms of like what has always been historically, almost everybody in the world has barely survived. Survival has always been extremely hard. That is not true for us here now. So either we will scale up what financial poverty is, or we'll look to different poverty, like Francisco was saying, or like we've noticed in this area. I want us to think about that as we look at this next passage in James chapter 1. As we start thinking about poverty, you can think about it. I'm not saying that you have to think about it one way or the other, but I just want you to have a kind of broader potential view of what it means to give charitably to those in need, what it means to be in need, what it means to have, and what it means to give. Here's some rules James lays out in James chapter 1. I love reading James because it's like if you've ever played a sport that you want to do good at, you want to have a coach that's going to like be really hard on you. James is the hardest coach I read. That dude pulls no punches. James was writing to people who've literally had their homes stripped from them. They're like, it's the diaspora. There wasn't a time in the early church when the Christians were more persecuted. And when you read James, you're thinking like, this does not sound like a man that's talking to people. This sounds like a man who's talking to people that are doing really well. They are not. These are people who are in desperate situation. And when you read him, you're like, he is throwing heat. And so in this part of the passage, he's talking about, for those of you that think you are religious, let me tell you what true religion is. This is the passage that gets to what he sees as the heart of religion. Pure and genuine religion in the sight of God in the sight of God the Father, or God and Father, means caring for orphans and widow in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Now, when I was really tearing this passage apart, the word pure, genuine, and unstained, I think James is doing something here. So the word pure is a positive word that just says like clean, like really good. But the word genuine, it has to do with like untainted or like not crooked, like straightened out. Like think something was crooked and straightened out, and actually unstained is kind of the correspondence to pure. Basically, what he's doing is, I don't think he intends for us to like think of these words as like different meanings. He's throwing out words that like three times in this one verse, in this one sentence, that positively and negatively reinforces the notion for the reader that true religion is straight, pure, clean, unblemished, unbroken. Like what I'm going to talk to you about here is religion that has been unmarred by your poor formation in a world that does not intend for you to follow Christ. You are constantly being formed in Christ and being malformed by the world. And he's saying, if you want to know what true religion is, unmolested by the world, this is it. Pure religion in the sight of God the Father means caring for orphans and widows in their distress and keeping oneself unstained. That word caring means to visit or to look upon. I think when we think about giving to the poor, especially in our culture, it is much more efficient to give through systems. There are systems in place that allow us to match up with people in need that we are unattached to, that we have no relationship with. This language he's talking about here means you are going to and being present to people that are in desperate situations in the middle of their desperation. That's I won't say that because you might have a great story. But something you might all think about is like, say, a person who's suddenly lost someone that they love, like someone has died suddenly, and you go to their house and you're sitting with them in the midst of their suffering, and you just think about what it means. Like, I want to be a good friend in this moment. For you to be a good friend means almost doing nothing. And almost all of your energy is spent observing, listening, paying attention, visiting. Like you are, all of your senses are trying to soak up any potential clue of what you can do to relieve this person's suffering. You're not starting from a position of like, oh, I've got money. Here, let me give you money. Visiting or caring for the poor, this word, that word for caring, means that you look upon, you look into, you stare into the lives of people in need in the midst of their stress. Distress, the word for distress there is pressure. Like We were talking about that this morning, about when, like, with the occupation or things going on, I don't necessarily feel pressure when it's happening. After it happens, I will often notice that I feel lighter. It's like the pressure that it's occurring, it's like life is just pressure and you just deal with it, right? After it happens, it's like there's this relief of pressure. Oh, that's good, you know? Sometimes, though, the pressure is so acute, so immediate, so thorough, that it's not something that you can ignore or write off or pretend doesn't exist. It's that constant, overwhelming sense that I'm not enough, that there's a fear, there's a sense of I don't know. God, what I can do for my child at this point. I don't know what I'm going to be able to do. Like I have this business that I don't know what I'm going to be able to do for my workers. I don't know. Like when you just sense that there is this pressure that you have an obligation to fulfill something and you feel helpless in a sense that you don't have the means to fulfill this thing that you are responsible for. You lack the resources. You don't have the resources. That's that pressure. And what James is saying, true religion is to observe when there are people who are in distress, who are in pressure, that you go and you are simply, you visit, you observe, you pay attention, you look for the means and opportunity to provide what God has given you to provide. It is very often not the thing that you start off thinking that you, like one of the worst things, and I've so done this, but like when a person is like in a really tough spot, we want to ask them, what can I do to help? It's like, bro, if I even knew where to start, that would be way better than where I'm at. And now you're putting me in the spot of I got to figure out what to do. I can't even figure out what to do tomorrow morning. And I'm supposed to tell you how you can help me. I don't know, you know. To be a person who can sit and be with a person in their distress and to care for them and to notice their need. And a lot of times it's not even the need that you first think of. This is where I think what we talked about the last 2 weeks, the prayer and fasting come into play. Very often I will, positively or negatively, like I'll think of you as, man, I really like, you're awesome, right? And I'll just like you, you know? But then when I pray for you and I ask God what he likes about you or what he wants for you, I'll notice things that I didn't notice before, you know? Or if you're at a really bad spot, health-wise or relationship-wise, something's going on with your kid or something, you know, it's really tough, it's hard. And I'll think, man, I hope this happens, or this is something that I wish the suffering would end, or I wish this thing would get figured out. But then when I pray and I ask God what he wants in that situation, it's often not what I thought beforehand. And I've noticed that both the need, both the poverty, and the resources that exist to meet that poverty, the relationship between being a person in a position to give and the need to give, change dramatically on the other side of prayer. James is saying here that true religion is to care. And widow and orphans is just shorthand for people in desperate situation. And James isn't saying only care for the widows and orphans. Obviously, anyone who is in a desperate situation. Widows and orphans was shorthand because always in their situation, the widows and orphans were always desperate. They were always in need. Anyone If you were a widow and orphan, that was just the assumption. That's where you were. You were outside of the household network that was going to provide for you. But it wasn't just widows and orphans in that spot. Anyone that we see, that we observe in deep need, giving alms, giving to the needy is really important. But he ties that to, he says that true religion is giving into them to visit them, to look upon them in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the world. This is where I think sometimes the inclination for Christians to do good is thwarted by our unwillingness to spend time asking God what is good first. Asking God to reveal, what does he want? Instead, I start off just assuming that I know what the need is. I hear the person hurting, and I just want them to not hurt. But oftentimes, they are just as confused about what they need as I am. Just because we're hurting doesn't mean we're smart about what we need in that situation. Sometimes I believe the suffering is to a greater end. In a world with sin, I think the absence of suffering would be just brutal. Think about what it would mean. Think about what it would mean for you to live. I am prepared to sin, do it often whenever I feel like I need to, and there is no ramifications to my sin. Well, why would I ever stop? I don't think that a world with suffering is such a bad idea from God, that suffering entered into the world when sin entered into the world was, I think, a means for us to return back to our greatest need. We are called back to God as a result of that suffering. I just want to relieve that suffering. But God may want to relieve something past that suffering. And I need to first ask God, what do you see here? What do you want? What do you hope for? What do you imagine? What can you see? For me, to be unstained by my worldly eyes, by my worldly view of things, how things ought to be first, so that I can then provide the need for the need, I think is really important. A lot of times we separate these two things out. I'm going to pray and I'm going to help people. And I think as a result, we make both prayer and helping people far less than they ought to be. I think they were intended to cooperate. All right. Jesus, you'd be surprised to hear, has something to say about this. In his Sermon on the Mount, which, you know, I love reading James, but if you turn to Matthew, like Matthew chapter 5, and you start with where the letters turn red, and you just keep reading for your few chapters where it's just all red letters, that's a good, it wouldn't be a bad idea for you to do that like once a month. Like it's really, like you think about this. This is the Son of God. So Jesus has a lot. Jesus is interacting, and he's like dealing with things as they come up, and he's like this pops up, and he responds to it. All that's really good, but Matthew records like when he has time to just say, "This is what I want you all to know," like not in response to a situation, just like here's broadly a scheme for life that I want you to understand. That is fit for the kingdom of God. Like, I think about that when I read the Sermon on the Mount. Like, this is Jesus's clean, just like statement of like, this is good living. He says, watch out in chapter 6. Watch out. Don't do your good deeds publicly to be admired by others, for you will lose the reward from your Father in heaven. And he says, when you give to someone in need, in the King James Version, it literally says, when you give alms to someone in need, don't do as the hypocrites do, blowing trumpets in the synagogues and streets to call attention to their acts of charity. I tell you the truth, they've received the reward, they received every reward they will get. But when you give to someone in need, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Give your gifts in private, and your Father, who sees everything, will reward you. Now, this isn't just a matter of humility. This isn't just like, hey, when you give, like, you have and they don't have, so be humble, right? This is actually, this is an act of love. When a person is in need, when a person is hurting, when a person lacks, they are vulnerable. And if you are trumpeting, if you're like, hey, man, we were with this situation, it felt good. It felt good for me to help somebody. And I want to like talk about it because it felt good for me to do that. And I want to like share that. That person that you've helped has now become the object of your good feeling. They've become your entertainment. Hey, it felt good going to that amusement park. I'm glad I did that. It felt good helping that person out. Let me tell you about that. You have now taken that person in need. You have helped them to your good. And Jesus is saying, your reason for giving, you've already gotten everything you're going to get out of it. Your full reward is on the table as soon as you, if that's your reason for helping, you have gotten your reward when you trumpet it. But when you look at that, when you pray for that person, you care for them, and you're not just seeing somebody like, oh, here's an opportunity to be a good person by doing this noble thing for this poor person that has less or needs more than I have. I know you wouldn't actually think all that, but when your intent and motivation is for your own good, I just want to be the kind of person, you know, I just want to be that guy, and I like feeling like that guy. Jesus says, great, if that's your motivation, you'll get exactly what you need out of it. But if your motivation is, you have seen that person, you have looked at them under pressure when they're hurting, and you're not relating to them based on your opportunity to be the hero, but you are studiously sensitive, you are paying attention to ways that you can step in and support a person when they're in their most vulnerable moment. Your goal is not to trumpet that to anybody. When a person is vulnerable, your goal is to make them less vulnerable and to keep that sensitive. All of the most beautiful things that I have ever seen happen in this church, I will never tell you about. I love the sensitivity that I see when people notice other people who are lacking, hurting, under pressure, and without need to feel better about themselves, they subtly come alongside and offer what that person needs in the moment. I'm in a position, I get to find out about it pretty often, just because sometimes people are like, hey, Clay, I've noticed this going on. What do you think? Can I, like, sometimes I help, and sometimes they're just looking for advice. I know a lot of stuff goes on I never know about, but I'm in a position, I get to find out a lot about a lot of stuff. And giving alms, like giving charity, has nothing to do with you feeling good about yourself. It has to do with the beauty of Christ, a family coming to the unfamilied. So when James says, the shorthand is widows and orphans, these are people who have been unfamilied. Family was where all that support and resource was expected would occur for people when they're lacking. Not that you don't have family, but a lot of us don't have the kind of extended type of network of family. We used to have aunts and uncles and neighbors, and like we used to have networks of family that in sensitive ways cared for each other in those moments. A lot of times we don't have that now, and I have seen you guys be that for each other when people were in need. That is charity. That's almsgiving. It has sometimes involved money. And then sometimes people who have been helped have decided that they wanted to share. They wanted to say what's... That's fine. If a person who has been helped wants to reveal that, that's fine. But I have not seen you guys needing to be the one to share when you've helped. And in my mind, that is almsgiving, biblically. That's what it really looks like to be a person, to be a church, to be a family who is noticing poverty, who is not just noticing it like from a distance where you just say like, oh yeah, that person's poor, but like noticing it because like you're in link group with them, because you have entered into a relationship with the people around you, that you have kind of a rhythm of life, that you can notice when something is really tough. You have not just decided, I need to help, but you've really observed, you sat with, you've noticed, you've looked, you know, you've really paid attention. You prayed, you asked for other people to pray with you about what to do. And when you helped in a very sensitive and gentle way, not revealing the need and not needing to have any sort of like hoopla about it. The need was met and you just, I wouldn't say just moved on. There's usually a bond that I see. There's good that occurs. It just usually isn't good that's like telegraphed to other people that weren't a part of it, you know? Okay. That's not usually, I think, the way almsgiving is described. Usually it's plainly about finances. And I would say historically, when 92% of people lived in extreme poverty, it made sense that fundamentally almsgiving was very much related to providing for people in physical, financial, food, like distress in the moment. That's not our culture as much, but that doesn't mean that we don't live it. I still, even though I don't see any of you wondering where your lunch is going to come from, I would not say that we live in a stress-free environment. I would not say that we are absent the oppression of the sense of not being enough or not knowing enough what to do. And so that poverty still exists, and I've seen you guys meet it. And I just want to say, I appreciate being a part of a church that's shown me what almsgiving looks like. I would just encourage you just to notice each other and pray. Father God, I thank you for James. I thank you for his bluntness about what it means to truly be a person who's generous and truly what religion is, Lord, that it's not just having a pure spirit where we're coming before you in prayer. It's not just being a person who's giving generously, Lord, but it is a person who's giving generously as a result of paying attention to the needs that exist that you see based on what you want. God, as we strive to be a church that is sensitive to what it means to be charitable, truly charitable to each other, I pray that the generosity and wisdom that comes out of it builds up the church in such a way that it is a reflection of you, and that we are your bride, Lord, and that we are honoring you in our beauty. We love you. Amen.